That's not a matter of curiosity to me, Dr. Lecter. And it's the sort of thing Miggs would ask. Not anymore. Did you suggest to him that he swallow his tongue? Your interrogative case often has that proper subjunctive in it. With your accent, it stinks of the lamp. Crawford clearly likes you and believes you competent. Surely the odd confluence of events hasn't escaped you, Clarice. You've had Crawford's help, and you've had mine. You say you don't know why Crawford helps you. Do you know why I did? No, tell me. Do you think it's because I like to look at you and think about eating you up? About how you would taste? Is that it? No. I want something Crawford can give me, and I want to trade him for it. But he won't come to see me. He won't ask for my help with Buffalo Bill, even though he knows it means more young women will die. I can't believe that, Dr. Lecter. I only want something very simple, and he could get it. Lecter turned up the rheostat slowly in his cell. His books and drawings were gone. His toilet seat was gone. Chilton had stripped the cell to punish him for Miggs. I've been in this room 8 years, Clarice. I know that they will never, ever let me out while I'm alive. What I want is a view. I want a window where I can see a tree or even water. Has your attorney petitioned Chilton put that television in the hall set to a religious channel? As soon as you leave, the orderly will turn the sound back up, and my attorney can't stop it, the way the court is inclined toward me now. I want to be in a federal institution, and I want my books back, and a view. I'll give good value for it. Crawford could do that. Ask him. I can tell him what you've said. He'll ignore it. And Buffalo Bill will go on and on. Wait until he scalps one and see how you like it. I'll tell you one thing about Buffalo Bill without ever seeing the case. And years from now, when they catch him, if they ever do, you'll see that I was right and I could have helped. I could have saved lives. Clarice? Yes? Buffalo Bill has a two-story house, Dr. Lecter said, and turned out his light. He would not speak again. Chapter 10. Clarice Starling leaned against a dice table in the FBI's casino and tried to pay attention to a lecture on money laundering and gambling. It had been 36 hours since the Baltimore County Police took her deposition, via a chain-smoking two-finger typist. See if you can get that window open if the smoke bothers you. And dismissed her from its jurisdiction with a reminder that murder is not a federal crime. The network news on Sunday night showed Starling's scrap with the television cameraman, and she felt sure she was deep in the glue. Through it all, no word from Crawford or from the Baltimore field office. It was as though she had dropped her report down a hole. The casino where she now stood was small. It had operated in a moving trailer truck until the FBI seized it and installed it in the school as a teaching aid. The narrow room was crowded with police from many jurisdictions. Starling had declined, with thanks, the chairs of two Texas Rangers and a Scotland Yard detective. The rest of her class were down the hall in the academy building, searching for hairs in the genuine motel carpet of the sex crime bedroom, and dusting the Anytown Bank for fingerprints. Starling had spent so many hours on searches and fingerprints as a forensic fellow that she was sent instead to this lecture, part of a series for visiting lawmen. She wondered if there was another reason she had been separated from the class. Maybe they isolate you before you get the axe. Starling rested her elbows on the pass line of the dice table and tried to concentrate on money laundering and gambling. What she thought about instead was how much the FBI hates to see its agents on television outside of official news conferences. Dr. Hannibal Lecter was catnip to the media, and the Baltimore police had happily supplied Starling's name to reporters. Over and over she saw herself on the Sunday night network news. There was Starling of the FBI in Baltimore, banging the jack handle against the garage door as the cameraman tried to slither under it. And here was Federal Agent Starling, turning on the assistant with the jack handle in her hand. On the rival network, station WPIK, lacking film of its own, had announced a personal injury lawsuit against Starling of the FBI and the Bureau itself, because the cameraman got dirt and rust particles in his eyes when Starling banged the door. Janetta Johnson of WPIK was on coast to coast with the revelation that Starling had found the remains in the garage through an eerie bonding with a man authorities have branded a monster. Clearly, WPIK had a source at the hospital. "Bride of Frankenstein," screamed the National Tattler from its supermarket racks. There was no public comment from the FBI, but there was plenty inside the Bureau, Starling was sure. At breakfast, one of her classmates, a young man who wore a lot of canoe aftershave, had referred to Starling as Melvin Pelvis, a stupid play on the name of Melvin Purvis, Hoover's number one G-man in the 30s. What Ardelia Mapp said to the young man made his face turn white, and he left his breakfast uneaten on the table. Now Starling found herself in a curious state in which she could not be surprised. For a day and a night she'd felt suspended in a diver's ringing silence. She intended to defend herself if she got the chance. The lecturer spun the roulette wheel as he talked, but he never let the ball drop. Looking at him, Starling was convinced that he had never let the ball drop in his life. He was saying something now. Clarice Starling. Why was he saying, "Clarice Starling, that's me"? "Yes," she said. The lecturer pointed with his chin at the door behind her. Here it came. Her fate shied under her as she turned to see. But it was Brigham, the gunnery instructor, leaning into the room to point to her across the crowd. When she saw him, he beckoned. For a second she thought they were throwing her out, but that wouldn't be Brigham's job. "Saddle up, Starling. Where's your field gear?" he said in the hall. "My room, C-Wing." She had to walk fast then to keep up with him. He was carrying the big fingerprint kit from the property room, the good one, not the play school kit, and a small canvas bag. "You go with Jack Crawford today. Take stuff for overnight. You may be back, but take it."
"Where?"
"Some duck hunters in West Virginia found a body in the Elk River around daylight, in a Buffalo Bill-type situation. Deputies are bringing it out. It's real boonies, and Jack's not inclined to wait on those guys for details." Brigham stopped at the door to C-Wing. "He needs somebody to help him that can print a floater, among other things. You are a grunt in the lab. You can do that, right?"
"Yeah. Let me check the stuff."
Brigham held the fingerprint kit open while Starling lifted out the trays. The fine hypodermics and the vials were there, but the camera wasn't.
"I need the one-to-one Polaroid, the CU-5, Mr. Brigham, and film packs and batteries for it."
"From property? You got it." He handed her the small canvas bag, and when she felt its weight, she realized why it was Brigham who had come for her. "You don't have a duty piece yet, right?"
"No."
"You gotta have full kit. This is the rig you've been wearing on the range. The gun is my own. It's the same K-frame Smith you've trained with, but the action's cleaned up. Dry fire it in your room tonight when you get the chance. I'll be in a car behind C-Wing in 10 minutes flat with the camera. Listen, there's no head in the blue canoe. Go to the bathroom while you got the chance is my advice. Chop, chop, Starling."
She tried to ask him a question, but he was leaving her. Has to be Buffalo Bill, if Crawford's going himself. What the hell is the blue canoe?
But you have to think about packing when you pack. Starling packed fast and well.
"Is it?"
"That's okay," Brigham interrupted as she got in the car. "The butt prints against your jacket a little if somebody's looking for it, but it's okay for now."
She was wearing the snub-nosed revolver under her blazer in a pancake holster snug against her ribs, with the speed loader straddling her belt on the other side. Brigham drove at precisely the base speed limit toward the Quantico airstrip. He cleared his throat.
"One good thing about the range, Starling, is there's no politics out there."
"No?"
"You were right to secure that garage up at Baltimore there. You worried about the TV?"
"Should I be?"
"We're talking just us, right?"
"Right."
Brigham returned the greeting of a Marine directing traffic. "Taking you along today, Jack's showing confidence in you where nobody can miss it.
he said. In case, say, somebody in the Office of Professional Responsibility has your jacket in front of him and his bowels in an uproar. Understand what I'm telling you? Crawford's a stand-up guy. He made it clear where it matters that you had to secure the scene. He let you go in there bare, that is, bare of all your visible symbols of authority, and he said that too. And the response time of the Baltimore cops was pretty slow. Also, Crawford needs the help today, and he'd have to wait an hour for Jimmy Price to get somebody here from the lab. So you got it cut out for you, Starling. A floater's no day at the beach either. It's not punishment for you, but if somebody outside needed to see it that way, they could. See, Crawford is a very subtle guy, but he's not inclined to explain things. That's why I'm telling you. If you're working with Crawford, you should know what the deal is with him. Do you know? I really don't. He's got a lot on his mind besides Buffalo Bill. His wife Bella's real sick. She's in a terminal situation. He's keeping her at home. If it wasn't for Buffalo Bill, he'd have taken compassionate leave. I didn't know that. It's not discussed. Don't tell him you're sorry or anything. It doesn't help him. They had a good time. I'm glad you told me. Brigham brightened as they reached the airstrip. I've got a couple of important speeches I gave at the end of the firearms course, Starling. Try not to miss them. He took a shortcut between some hangars. I will. Listen, what I teach is something you probably won't ever have to do. I hope you won't. But you've got some aptitude, Starling. If you have to shoot, you can shoot. Do your exercises.
Right.
Don't ever put it in your purse.
Right.
Pull it a few times in your room at night. Stay so you can find it.
I will.
A venerable twin-engine Beechcraft stood on the taxiway at the Quantico airstrip with its beacons turning and the door open. One propeller was spinning, riffling the grass beside the tarmac.
That wouldn't be the Blue Canoe, Starling said.
Yep. It's little and it's old. It is old, Brigham said cheerfully. Drug enforcement seized it in Florida a long time ago when it flopped in the Glades. Mechanically sound now, though. I hope Graham and Rudman don't find out we're using it, and we're supposed to ride the bus. He pulled up beside the airplane and got Starling's baggage out of the back seat. In some confusion of hands, he managed to give her the stuff and shake her hand. And then, without meaning to, Brigham said, "Bless you, Starling." The words felt odd in his marine mouth. He didn't know where they came from, and his face felt hot.
"Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Brigham."
Crawford was in the co-pilot's seat, in shirt sleeves and sunglasses. He turned to Starling when he heard the pilot slam the door. She couldn't see his eyes behind the dark glasses, and she felt she didn't know him. Crawford looked pale and tough, like a root a bulldozer pushes up.
"Take a pew and read," is all he said.
A thick case file lay on the seat behind him. The cover said, "Buffalo Bill." Starling hugged it tight as the Blue Canoe blatted and shuddered and began to roll. Chapter 11. The edges of the runway blurred and fell away. To the east, a flash of morning sun off the Chesapeake Bay as the small plane turned out of traffic. Clarice Starling could see the school down there and the surrounding marine base at Quantico. On the assault course, tiny figures of Marines scrambled and ran. This was how it looked from above. Once after a night firing exercise, walking in the dark along the deserted Hogan's Alley, walking to think, she had heard airplanes roar over, and then in the new silence, voices calling in the black sky above her, airborne troops in a night jump calling to each other as they came down through the darkness. And she wondered how it felt to wait for the jump light at the aircraft door, how it felt to plunge into the bellowing dark. Maybe it felt like this. She opened the file. He had done it 5 times that they knew of, had Bill. At least 5 times, and probably more over the past 10 months, he had abducted a woman, killed her, and skinned her. Starling's eye raced down the autopsy protocols to the free histamine tests to confirm that he killed them before he did the rest. He dumped each body in running water when he was through with it. Each was found in a different river, downstream from an interstate highway crossing, each in a different state. Everyone knew Buffalo Bill was a traveling man. That was all the law knew about him, absolutely all, except that he had at least one gun. It had six lands and grooves, left-hand twist, possibly a Colt revolver or a Colt clone. Skid marks on recovered bullets indicated he preferred to fire .38 specials in the longer chambers of a .357. The rivers left no fingerprints, no trace evidence of hair or fiber. He was almost certain to be a white male, white because serial murderers usually kill within their own ethnic group, and all the victims were white, male because female serial murderers are almost unknown in our time. Two big city columnists had found a headline in E.E. Cummings' deadly little poem, Buffalo Bill. How do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? Someone, maybe Crawford, had pasted the quotation inside the cover of the file. There was no clear correlation between where Bill abducted the young women and where he dumped them. In the cases where the bodies were found soon enough for an accurate determination of time of death, police learned another thing the killer did. Bill kept them for a while alive. These victims did not die until a week to 10 days after they were abducted. That meant he had to have a place to keep them, and a place to work in privacy. It meant he wasn't a drifter. He was more of a trapdoor spider, with his own digs, somewhere. That horrified the public more than anything. His holding them for a week or more, knowing he would kill them. Two were hanged, three shot. There was no evidence of rape or physical abuse prior to death, and the autopsy protocols recorded no evidence of specifically genital disfigurement, though pathologists noted it would be almost impossible to determine these things in the more deteriorated bodies. All were found naked. In two cases, articles of the victim's outer clothing were found beside the road near their homes, slid up the back like funeral suits. Starling got through the photographs all right. Floaters are the worst kind of dead to deal with, physically. There is an absolute pathos about them, too, as there often is about homicide victims out of doors. The indignities the victim suffers, the exposure to the elements and to casual eyes, anger you. If your job permits you anger. Often, at indoor homicides, evidences of a victim's unpleasant personal practices and the victim's own victims, beaten spouses, abused children, crowd around to whisper that the dead one had it coming, and many times he did. But nobody had this coming. Here they had not even their skins, as they lay on littered river banks amid the outboard oil bottles and sandwich bags that are our common squalor. The cold weather ones largely retained their faces. Starling reminded herself that their teeth were not bared in pain, that turtles and fish in the course of feeding had created that expression. Bill peeled the torsos and mostly left the limbs alone. They wouldn't have been so hard to look at, Starling thought, if this airplane cabin wasn't so warm, and if the damned plane didn't have this crawly yaw as one prop caught the air better than the other, and if the goddamned sun didn't splinter so on the scratched windows and jab like a headache. It's possible to catch him. Starling squeezed on that thought to help herself sit in this ever smaller airplane cabin with her lap full of awful information. She could help stop him cold. Then they could put this slightly sticky, smooth-covered file back in the drawer and turn the key on it. She stared at the back of Crawford's head. If she wanted to stop Buffalo Bill, she was in the right crowd. Crawford had organized successful hunts for 3 serial murderers, but not without casualties. Will Graham, the keenest hound ever to run in Crawford's pack, was a legend at the academy. He was also a drunk in Florida now, with a face that was hard to look at, they said. Maybe Crawford felt her staring at the back of his head. He climbed out of the co-pilot's seat. The pilot touched the trim wheel as Crawford came back to her and buckled in beside her. When he folded his sunglasses and put on his bifocals, she felt she knew him again. When he looked from her face to the report and back again, something passed behind his face and was quickly gone. A more animated mug than Crawford's would have shown regret.
"I'm hot. Are you hot?" he said. "Bobby, it's too damned hot in here," he called to the pilot.
Bobby adjusted something and cold air came in. A few snowflakes formed in the moist cabin air and settled in Starling's hair. Then it was Jack Crawford hunting, his eyes like a bright winter day. He opened the file to a map of the central and eastern United States. Locations where bodies had been found were marked on the map, a scattering of dots as mute and crooked as Orion. Crawford took a pen from his pocket and marked the newest location, their objective.
"Elk River, about 6 miles below U.S. 79, he said. "We're lucky on this one. The body was snagged on a trot line, a fishing line set out in the river. They don't think she's been in the water all that long. They're bringing her to Potter, the county seat. I want to know who she is in a hurry so we can sweep for witnesses to the abduction. We'll send the prints back on a landline as soon as we get them."
Crawford tilted his head to look at Starling through the bottoms of his glasses.
"Jimmy Price says you can do a floater."
"Actually, I never had an entire floater," Starling said. "I fingerprinted the hands Mr. Price got in his mail every day. A good many of them were from floaters, though."
Those who have never been under Jimmy Price's supervision believe him to be a lovable curmudgeon. Like most curmudgeons, he is really a mean old man. Jimmy Price is a supervisor in latent prints at the Washington lab. Starling did time with him as a forensic fellow. "That Jimmy," Crawford said fondly. "What is it they call that job?"
"The position is called lab wretch, or some people prefer Igor. That's what's printed on the rubber apron they give you."
"That's it."
"They tell you to pretend you're dissecting a frog."
"I see."
"Then they bring you a package from UPS. They're all watching. Some of them hurry back from coffee, hoping you'll barf." "I can print a floater very well. In fact..."
"Good. Now look at this. His first victim that we know of was found in the Blackwater River in Missouri, outside of Lone Jack, last June. The Bimmel girl. She'd been reported missing in Belvedere, Ohio, on April 15, 2 months before. We couldn't tell a lot about it. It took another 3 months just to get her identified. The next one he grabbed in Chicago, the third week in April. She was found in the Wabash in downtown Lafayette, Indiana, just 10 days after she was taken, so we could tell what had happened to her. Next, we've got a white female, early 20s, dumped in the Rolling Fork near I-65, about 38 miles south of Louisville, Kentucky. She's never been identified. And the Varner woman, grabbed in Evansville, Indiana, and dropped in the Embarrass just below Interstate 70 in eastern Illinois. Then he moved south and dumped one in the Conasauga below Damascus, Georgia, down from Interstate 75. That was this Kittredge girl from Pittsburgh. Here's her graduation picture. His luck's ungodly. Nobody's ever seen him make a snatch. Except for the dumps being near an interstate, we haven't seen any pattern.
If you trace heaviest traffic routes backward from the dump sites, do they converge at all?
No.
What if you postulate that he's making a drop-off and a new abduction on the same trip? Starling asked, carefully avoiding the forbidden word assume. He'd drop off the body first, wouldn't he, in case he got in trouble grabbing the next one? Then if he was caught grabbing somebody, he might get off for assault, plead it down to zip if he didn't have a body in his car. So how about drawing vectors backward from each abduction site through the previous dump site? You've tried it.
That's a good idea, but he had it too. If he is doing both things in one trip, he's zigging around. We've run computer simulations, first with him westbound on the interstates, then eastbound, then various combinations with the best dates we can put on the dumps and abductions. You put it in the computer and smoke comes out. He lives in the east, it tells us. He's not in a moon cycle, it tells us. No convention dates in the cities correlate. Nothing but feathers. No, he's seen us coming, Starling.
You think he's too careful to be a suicide?
Crawford nodded. Definitely too careful. He's found out how to have a meaningful relationship now, and he wants to do it a lot. I'm not getting my hopes up for a suicide.
Crawford passed the pilot a cup of water from a thermos. He gave one to Starling and mixed himself an Alka-Seltzer. Her stomach lifted as the airplane started down. "Couple of things, Starling. I look for first-rate forensics from you, but I need more than that. You don't say much, and that's okay, neither do I. But don't ever feel you've got to have a new fact to tell me before you can bring something up. There aren't any silly questions. You'll see things that I won't, and I want to know what they are. Maybe you've got a knack for this. All of a sudden we've got this chance to see if you do." Listening to him, her stomach lifting and her expression properly wrapped, Starling wondered how long Crawford had known he'd use her on this case, how hungry for a chance he had wanted her to be. He was a leader, with a leader's frank and open bullshit, all right. "You think about him enough, you see where he's been, you get a feel for him," Crawford went on. "You don't even dislike him all the time, hard as that is to believe. Then, if you're lucky, out of all the stuff you know, part of it plucks at you, tries to get your attention. Always tell me when something plucks, darling. Listen to me, a crime is confusing enough without the investigation mixing it up. Don't let a herd of policemen confuse you. Live right behind your eyes. Listen to yourself. Keep the crime separate from what's going on around you now. Don't try to impose any pattern or symmetry on this guy. Stay open and let him show you. One other thing. An investigation like this is a zoo. It's spread out over a lot of jurisdictions, and a few are run by losers. We have to get along with them so they won't hold out on us. We're going to Potter, West Virginia. I don't know about these people we're going to. They may be fine, or they may think we're the revenuers." The pilot lifted an earphone away from his head and spoke over his shoulder. "Final approach, Jack. You staying back there?"
"Yeah," Crawford said.
"School's out, Starling."
Chapter 12. Now here is the Potter Funeral Home, the largest white frame house on Potter Street in Potter, West Virginia, serving as the morgue for Rankin County. The coroner is a family physician named Dr. Aiken. If he rules that a death is questionable, the body is sent on to Claxton Regional Medical Center in the neighboring county, where they have a trained pathologist. Clarice Starling, riding into Potter from the airstrip in the back of a sheriff's department cruiser, had to lean up close to the prisoner's screen to hear the deputy at the wheel as he explained these things to Jack Crawford. A service was about to get underway at the mortuary. The mourners in their country Sunday best filed up the sidewalk between leggy boxwoods and bunched on the steps waiting to get in. The freshly painted house and the steps had, each in its own direction, settled slightly out of plumb. In the private parking lot behind the house where the hearses waited, two young deputies and one old one stood with two state troopers under a bare elm. It was not cold enough for their breath to steam. Starling looked at these men as the cruiser pulled into the lot, and at once she knew about them. She knew they came from houses that had chifferobes instead of closets, and she knew pretty much what was in the chifferobes. She knew that these men had relatives who hung their clothes in suit bags on the walls of their trailers. She knew that the older deputy had grown up with a pump on the porch and had waded to the road in the muddy spring to catch the school bus with his shoes hanging around his neck by the laces, as her father had done. She knew that they had carried their lunches to school in paper sacks with grease spots on them from being used over and over, and that after lunch they folded the sacks and slipped them in the back pockets of their jeans. She wondered how much Crawford knew about them. There were no handles on the inside of the rear doors in the cruiser, as Starling discovered when the driver and Crawford got out and started toward the back of the funeral home. She had to bat on the glass until one of the deputies beneath the tree saw her, and the driver came back red-faced to let her out. The deputies watched her sidelong as she passed. One said, "Ma'am." She gave them a nod and a smile of the correct dim wattage as she went to join Crawford on the back porch. When she was far enough away, one of the younger deputies, a newlywed, scratched beneath his jaw and said, "She don't look half as good as she thinks she does."
"Well, if she just thinks she looks pretty goddamn good, I'd have to agree with her myself," the other young deputy said. "I'd put her on like a Mark V gas mask."
I'd just soon have a big watermelon if it was cold, the older deputy said, half to himself.
Crawford was already talking to the chief deputy, a small, taut man in steel-rimmed glasses and the kind of elastic-sided boots the catalogs call Romeos. They had moved into the funeral home's dim back corridor, where a Coke machine hummed and random odd objects stood against the wall, a treadle sewing machine, a tricycle, and a roll of artificial grass, a striped canvas awning wrapped around its poles. On the wall was a sepia print of St. Cecilia at the keyboard. Her hair was braided around her head, and roses tumbled onto the keys out of thin air.
"I appreciate your letting us know so fast, Sheriff," Crawford said.
The chief deputy wasn't having any.
"It was somebody from the district attorney's office called you," he said. "I know the sheriff didn't call you. Sheriff Perkins is on a guided tour of Hawaii at the present time with Mrs. Perkins. I spoke to him on long distance this morning at 8 o'clock. That's 3 a.m. Hawaii time. He'll get back to me later in the day, but he told me job one is to find out if this is one of our local girls. It could be something that outside elements has just dumped on us. We'll tend to that before we do anything else. We've had 'em haul bodies here all the way from Phoenix City, Alabama."
"That's where we can help you, Sheriff.
If I've been on the phone with the field services commander of the state troopers in Charleston, he's sending some officers from the criminal investigation section, what's known as the CIS. They'll give us all the backup we need."
The corridor was filling with deputy sheriffs and troopers. The chief deputy had too much of an audience.
"We'll get around to you just as soon as we can, and extend you every courtesy, work with you every way we can. But right now,
Sheriff, this kind of sex crime has some aspects that I'd rather say to you just between us men. You understand what I mean?" Crawford said, indicating Starling's presence with a small movement of his head.
He hustled the smaller man into a cluttered office off the hall and closed the door. Starling was left to mask her umbrage before the gaggle of deputies. Her teeth hard together, she gazed on St. Cecilia and returned the saint's ethereal smile while eavesdropping through the door. She could hear raised voices, then scraps of a telephone conversation. They were back out in the hall in less than 4 minutes. The chief deputy's mouth was tight.
"Oscar, go out front and get Dr. Aiken. He's kind of obliged to attend those rites, but I don't think they've got started out there yet. Tell him we've got Claxton on the phone."
The coroner, Dr. Aiken, came to the little office and stood with his foot on a chair, tapping his front teeth with a Good Shepherd fan while he had a brief telephone conference with a pathologist in Claxton. Then he agreed to everything. So, in an embalming room with cabbage roses in the wallpaper and a picture molding beneath its high ceiling in a white frame house of a type she understood, Clarice Starling met with her first direct evidence of Buffalo Bill. The bright green body bag, tightly zipped, was the only modern object in the room. It lay on an old-fashioned porcelain embalming table, reflected many times in the glass panes of cabinets holding trocars and packages of rock-hard cavity fluid. Crawford went to the car for the fingerprint transmitter, while Starling unpacked her equipment on the drain board of a large double sink against the wall. Too many people were in the room. Several deputies, the chief deputy, all had wandered in with them and showed no inclination to leave. It wasn't right. Why didn't Crawford come in and get rid of them? The wallpaper billowed in a draft, billowed inward as the doctor turned on the big dusty vent fan. Clarice Starling, standing at the sink, needed now a prototype of courage more apt and powerful than any marine parachute jump. The image came to her and helped her, but it pierced her, too. Her mother, standing at the sink, washing blood out of her father's hat, running cold water over the hat, saying, "We'll be all right, Clarice. Tell your brothers and sisters to wash up and come to the table. We need to talk, and then we'll fix our supper." Starling took off her scarf and tied it over her hair like a mountain midwife. She took a pair of surgical gloves out of her kit. When she opened her mouth for the first time in Potter, her voice had more than its normal twang, and the force of it brought Crawford to the door to listen.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen, you officers and gentlemen, listen here a minute, please. Now let me take care of her."
She held her hands before their faces as she pulled on the gloves.
"There's things we need to do for her.
You brought her this far, and I know her folks would thank you if they could. Now please go on out and let me take care of her." Crawford saw them suddenly go quiet and respectful and urge each other out in whispers. "Come on, Jess, let's go out in the yard." And Crawford saw that the atmosphere had changed here in the presence of the dead, that wherever this victim came from, whoever she was, the river had carried her into the country, and while she lay helpless in this room in the country, Clarice Starling had a special relationship to her. Crawford saw that in this place Starling was heir to the granny women, to the wise women, the herb healers, the stalwart country women who have always done the needful, who keep the watch, and when the watch is over, wash and dress the country dead. Then there were only Crawford and Starling and the doctor in the room with the victim. Dr. Aiken and Starling looked at each other with a kind of recognition. Both of them were oddly pleased, oddly abashed. Crawford took a jar of Vicks Vapor Rub out of his pocket and offered it around. Starling watched to see what to do, and when Crawford and the doctor rubbed it around the rims of their nostrils, she did too. She dug her cameras out of the equipment bag on the drain board, her back to the room. Behind her, she heard the zipper of the body bag go down. Starling blinked at the cabbage roses on the wall, took a breath, and let it out. She turned around and looked at the body on the table. "They should have put paper bags on her hands," she said. "I'll bag them when we're through." Carefully, overriding the automatic camera to bracket her exposures, Starling photographed the body. The victim was a heavy-hipped young woman, 67 inches long by Starling's tape. The water had leached her gray where the skin was gone, but it had been cold water, and she clearly hadn't been in it more than a few days. The body was flayed neatly from a clean line just below the breasts to the knees, about the area that would be covered by a bullfighter's pants and sash. Her breasts were small, and between them, over the sternum, was the apparent cause of death, a ragged, star-shaped wound a hand's breadth across. Her round head was peeled to the skull, from just above the eyebrows and ears to the nape. "Dr. Lecter said he'd start scalping," Starling said. Crawford stood with his arms folded while she took the pictures. "Get her ears with the Polaroid," was all he said. He went so far as to purse his lips as he walked around the body. Starling peeled off her glove to trail her finger up the calf of the leg. A section of the trot line and treble fish hooks that had entangled and held the body in the moving river was still wrapped around the lower leg. "What do you see, Starling?" "Well, she's not a local. Her ears are pierced 3 times each, and she wore glitter polish. Looks like town to me. She's got maybe 2 weeks or so hair growth on her legs, and see how soft it's grown in? I think she got her legs waxed. Armpits, too. Look how she bleached the fuzz on her upper lip. She was pretty careful about herself, but she hadn't been able to take care of it for a while." "What about the wound?" "I don't know," Starling said. "I would have said an exit gunshot wound, except that looks like part of an abrasion collar and a muzzle stamp at the top there." "Good, Starling. It's a contact entrance wound over the sternum. The explosion gases expand between the bone and the skin and blow out the star around the hole." On the other side of the wall, a pipe organ wheezed as the service got underway in the front of the funeral home. "Wrongful death," Dr. Aikens contributed, nodding his head. "I've got to get in there for at least part of this service. The family always expects me to go the last mile. Lamar will be in here to help you as soon as he finishes playing the musical offering. I'll take you at your word on preserving evidence for the pathologist at Claxton, Mr. Crawford." "She's got 2 nails broken off here on the left hand," Starling said when the doctor was gone. "They're broken back up in the quick, and it looks like dirt or some hard particles driven up under some of the others. Can we take evidence?" "Take samples of grit. Take a couple of flakes of polish," Crawford said. "We'll tell him after we get the results." Lamar, a lean funeral home assistant with a whiskey bloom in the middle of his face, came in while she was doing it. "You must have been a manicurist one time," he said. They were glad to see the young woman had no fingernail marks in her palms, an indication that, like the others, she had died before anything else was done to her. "You want to print her face down, Starling?" Crawford said. "Be easier." Let's do teeth first, and then Lamar can help us turn her over.
Just pictures or a chart? Starling attached the dental kit to the front of the fingerprint camera, privately relieved that all the parts were in the bag.
Just pictures, Crawford said. A chart can throw you off without x-rays. We can eliminate a couple of missing women with the pictures.
Lamar was very gentle with his organist's hands, opening the young woman's mouth at Starling's direction and retracting her lips while Starling placed the one-to-one Polaroid against the face to get details of the front teeth. That part was easy, but she had to shoot the molars with a palatal reflector, watching from the side for the glow through the cheek to be sure the strobe around the lens was lighting the inside of the mouth. She had only seen it done in a forensics class. Starling watched the first Polaroid print of the molars develop, adjusted the lightness control, and tried again. This print was better. This one was very good.
"She's got something in her throat," Starling said.
Crawford looked at the picture. It showed a dark, cylindrical object just behind the soft palate.
"Give me the flashlight."
"When a body comes out of the water, a lot of times there's like leaves and things in the mouth," Lamar said, helping Crawford to look.
Starling took some forceps out of her bag. She looked at Crawford across the body. He nodded. It only took her a second to get it.
"What is it, some kind of seed pod?" Crawford said.
"Oh, sir, that's a bug cocoon," Lamar said.
He was right. Starling put it in a jar.
"You might want the county agent to look at that," Lamar said.
Face down, the body was easy to fingerprint. Starling had been prepared for the worst, but none of the tedious and delicate injection methods or finger stalls were necessary. She took the prints on thin cardstock held in a device shaped like a shoehorn. She did a set of plantar prints as well, in case they had only baby footprints from a hospital for reference. Two triangular pieces of skin were missing from high on the shoulders. Starling took pictures.
"Measure two," Crawford said.
He cut the girl from Akron where he slit her clothes off. Not much more than a scratch, but it matched the cut up the back of her blouse when they found it beside the road.
"This is something new, though. I haven't seen this."
"Looks like a burn across the back of her calf," Starling said.
"Old people gets those a lot," Lamar said.
"What?" Crawford said.
"I said old people gets those a lot."
"I heard you fine. I want you to explain it. What about old people?"
"Old people pass away with a heating pad on them, and when they're dead it burns them, even when they're not all that hot. You burn under a heating pad when you're dead. No circulation under it."
"We'll ask the pathologist at Claxton to test it and see if it's post-mortem," Crawford said to Starling.
"Car muffler, most likely," Lamar said.
"What?"
Car muffler. One time Billy Petrie got shot to death and they dumped him in the trunk of his car. His wife drove the car around 2 or 3 days looking for him. When they brought him in here, the muffler got hot under the car trunk and burned him just like that, only crossed his hip," Lamar said. "I can't put groceries in the trunk of my car for it melting the ice cream."
"That's a good thought, Lamar. I wish you worked for me," Crawford said. "Do you know the fellows that found her in the river?"
"Yabo Franklin and his brother Bubba."
"What do they do?"
"Fight at the moose, make fun of people that's not bothering them. Someone just comes in the moose after a simple drink, worn out from looking at the bereaved all day, and it's, 'Set down there, Lamar, and play Filipino baby.' Make a person play Filipino baby over and over in that sticky old bar piano. That's what Yabo likes. 'Well, make up some damn words if you don't know it,' he says, 'and make the damn thing rhyme this time.' He gets a check from the veterans and goes out to dry out at the VA around Christmas. I've been looking for him on this table for 15 years.
"We'll need serotonin tests on the fish hook punctures," Crawford said. "I'm sending the pathologist a note."
"Damn hooks are too close together," Lamar said.
"What did you say?"
"The Franklins was running a trot line with the hooks too close together. It's a violation. That's probably why they didn't call it in until this morning."
"The sheriff said they were duck hunters."
"I expect they did tell him that," Lamar said. "They'll tell you they wrestled Duke Kayamuka in Honolulu one time, too. Tag team with Satellite Monroe. You can believe that, too, if you feel like it." Grab a croaker sack, and they'll take you on a snipe hunt, too, if you favor snipe. Give you a glass of billiards with it.
What do you think happened, Lamar?
The Franklins was running this trot line. It's their trot line with these unlawful hooks, and they was pulling it up to see if they had any fish.
Why do you think so?
This lady's not near ready to float.
No.
Then if they hadn't have been pulling up on the trot line, they never would have found her. They probably went off scared and finally called in. I expect you'll want the game warden in on this.
I expect so, Crawford said.
Lots of times they've got a cranked telephone behind the seat in their ram charger. That's a big fine right there if you don't have to go to the pen.
Crawford raised his eyebrows.
To telephone fish with, Starling said. Stun the fish with electric current when you hang the wires in the water and turn the crank. They come to the top and you just dip them out.
Right, Lamar said. You from around here?
They do it lots of places, Starling said.
Starling felt the urge to say something before they zipped up the bag, to make a gesture or express some kind of commitment. In the end, she just shook her head and got busy packing the samples into her case. It was different, with the body and problem out of sight. In this slack moment, what she'd been doing came in on her. Starling stripped off her gloves and turned the water on in the sink. With her back to the room, she ran water over her wrists. The water in the pipes wasn't all that cool. Lamar, watching, disappeared into the hall. He came back from the Coke machine with an ice-cold can of soda, unopened, and offered it to her.
No thanks, Starling said. I don't believe I'll have one.
No, hold it under your neck there, Lamar said. And on that little bump at the back of your head, cold will make you feel better.
It does me.
By the time Starling had finished taping the memo to the pathologist across the zipper of the body bag, Crawford's fingerprint transmitter was clicking on the office desk. Finding this victim so soon after the crime was a lucky break. Crawford was determined to identify her quickly and start a sweep around her home for witnesses to the abduction. His method was a lot of trouble to everyone, but it was fast. Crawford carried a Litton Police Fax fingerprint transmitter. Unlike federal-issue facsimile machines, the Police Fax is compatible with most big city police department systems. The fingerprint card Starling had assembled was barely dry.
"Load it, Starling. You've got the nimble fingers."
"Don't smear it," was what he meant, and Starling didn't. It was hard, wrapping the glued-together composite card around the little drum while six wire rooms waited around the country. Crawford was on the telephone to the FBI switchboard and wire room in Washington.
"Dorothy, is everybody on?"
"Okay, gentlemen, we'll turn it down to 120 to keep it nice and sharp. Check 120, everybody. Atlanta, how about it?"
"Okay, give me the picture wire. Now."
Then it was spinning at slow speed for clarity, sending the dead woman's print simultaneously to the FBI wire room and major police department wire rooms in the east. If Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, or any of the others got a hit on their fingerprints, a sweep would begin in minutes. Next, Crawford sent pictures of the victim's teeth and photos of her face, the head draped by Starling with a towel in the event the supermarket press got hold of the photographs. Three officers of the West Virginia State Police Criminal Investigation Section arrived from Charleston as they were leaving. Crawford did a lot of handshaking, passing out cards with the National Crime Information Center hotline number. Starling was interested to see how fast he got them into a mail bonding mode. They sure would call up with anything they got. They sure would. You betcha, and much oblige. Maybe it wasn't mail bonding, she decided. It worked on her, too. Lamar waved with his fingers from the porch as Crawford and Starling rode away with the deputy toward the Elk River. The Coke was still pretty cold. Lamar took it into the storeroom and fixed a refreshing beverage for himself.
Chapter 13.
"Drop me at the lab, Jeff," Crawford told the driver. "Then I want you to wait for Officer Starling at the Smithsonian. She'll go on from there to Quantico."
"Yes, sir."
They were crossing the Potomac River against the after-dinner traffic, coming into downtown Washington from National Airport. The young man at the wheel seemed in awe of Crawford and drove with excessive caution, Starling thought. She didn't blame him. It was an article of faith at the Academy that the last agent who'd committed a full fuck-up in Crawford's command now investigated pilfering at dew-line installations along the Arctic Circle. Crawford was not in a good humor. 9 hours had passed since he transmitted the fingerprints and pictures of the victim, and she remained unidentified. Along with the West Virginia troopers, he and Starling had worked the bridge in the riverbank until dark without result. Starling had heard him on the phone from the airplane, arranging for an evening nurse at home. The FBI Plain Jane sedan seemed wonderfully quiet after the blue canoe, and talking was easier. "I'll post the hotline and the latent descriptor index when I take your prints up to ID," Crawford said. "You draft me an insert for the file. An insert, not a 302. Do you know how to do it?"
"I know how."
"Say I'm the index. Tell me what's new." It took her a second to get it together. She was glad Crawford seemed interested in the scaffolding on the Jefferson Memorial as they passed by. The latent descriptor index in the identification section's computer compares the characteristics of a crime under investigation to the known proclivities of criminals on file. When it finds pronounced similarities, it suggests suspects and produces their fingerprints. Then a human operator compares the file fingerprints with latent prints found at the scene. There were no prints yet on Buffalo Bill, but Crawford wanted to be ready. The system requires brief, concise statements. Starling tried to come up with some. "White female, late teens or early 20s, shot to death, lower torso and thighs flayed."
"Starling, the index already knows he kills young white women and skins their torsos. Use skinned, by the way. Flayed is an uncommon term another officer might not use, and you can't be sure the damn thing will read a synonym. It already knows he dumps them in rivers. It doesn't know what's new here." "What's new here, Starling?"
"This is the sixth victim, the first one scalped, the first one with triangular patches taken from the back of the shoulders, the first one shot in the chest, the first one with a cocoon in her throat."
"You forgot broken fingernails."
No, sir, she's the second one with broken fingernails."
"You're right. Listen, in your insert for the file, note that the cocoon is confidential. We'll use it to eliminate false confessions."
"I'm wondering if he's done that before, placed a cocoon or an insect," Starling said. "It would be easy to miss in an autopsy, especially with a floater. You know, the medical examiner sees an obvious cause of death, it's hot in there, and they want to get through. Can we check back on that?"
"If we have to. You can count on the pathologists to say they didn't miss anything, naturally. The Cincinnati Jane Doe's still in the freezer out there. I'll ask them to look at her. But the other four are in the ground. Exhumation orders stir people up. We had to do it with four patients who passed away under Dr. Lecter's care just to make sure what killed them. Let me tell you, it's a lot of trouble and it upsets the relatives. I'll do it if I have to, but we'll see what you find out at the Smithsonian before I decide."
"Scalping? That's rare, isn't it?"
"Uncommon, yes," Crawford said.
"But Dr. Lecter said Buffalo Bill would do it. How did he know that?"
"He didn't know it."
"He said it, though."
"It's not a big surprise, Starling. I wasn't surprised to see that. I should have said that it was rare until the Mengel case, remember that? Scalp the woman? There were two or three copycats after that. The papers, when they were playing around with the Buffalo Bill tag, they emphasized more than once that this killer doesn't take scalps. It's no surprise after that. He probably follows his press." Lecter was guessing. He didn't say when it would happen, so he could never be wrong. If we caught Bill and there was no scalping, Lecter could say we got him just before he did it.
"Dr. Lecter also said Buffalo Bill lives in a two-story house. We never got into that. Why do you suppose he said it?"
"That's not a guess. He's very likely right. And he could have told you why, but he wanted to tease you with it. It's the only weakness I ever saw in him. He has to look smart, smarter than anybody. He's been doing it for years."
"You said ask if I don't know. Well, I have to ask you to explain that."
"Okay, two of the victims were hanged, right? High ligature marks, cervical displacement, definite hanging. As Dr. Lecter knows from personal experience, Starling, it's very hard for one person to hang another against his will. People hang themselves from doorknobs all the time. They hang themselves sitting down. It's easy. But it's hard to hang somebody else, even when they're bound up. They manage to get their feet under them, if there's any support to find with their feet. A ladder's threatening. Victims won't climb it blindfolded, and they sure won't climb it if they can see the noose.
The way it's done is in a stairwell. Stairs are familiar. Tell them you're taking them up to use the bathroom, whatever. Walk them up with a hood on, slip the noose on, and boot them off the top step with the rope fastened to the landing railing. It's the only good way in a house. A fellow in California popularized it. If Bill didn't have a stairwell, he'd kill them another way. Now give me those names, the senior deputy from Potter and the state police guy, the ranking officer. Starling found them in her notepad, reading by a penlight held in her teeth. Good, Crawford said. When you're posting a hotline, Starling, always credit the cops by name. They hear their own names, they get more friendly to the hotline. Fame helps them remember to call us if they get something. What does the burn on her leg say to you? Depends if it's post-mortem. If it is, then he's got a closed truck or a van or a station wagon, something long. Why? Because the burn's across the back of her calf. They were at 10th in Pennsylvania, in front of the new FBI headquarters that nobody ever refers to as the J. Edgar Hoover building. Jeff, you can let me out here, Crawford said. Right here, don't go underneath. Stay in the car, Jeff, just pop the trunk. Come show me, Starling. She got out with Crawford while he retrieved his data fax and briefcase from the luggage compartment. He hauled the body in something big enough for the body to be stretched out on its back, Starling said. That's the only way the back of her calf would rest on the floor over the exhaust pipe. In a car trunk like this, she'd be curled up on her side and...
Yeah, that's how I see it, Crawford said.
She realized then that he'd gotten her out of the car so he could speak with her privately. When I told that deputy he and I shouldn't talk in front of a woman, that burned you, didn't it?
Sure.
It was just smoke. I wanted to get him by myself.
I know that.
Okay. Crawford slammed the trunk and turned away. Starling couldn't let it go.
It matters, Mr. Crawford.
He was turning back to her, laden with his fax machine and briefcase, and she had his full attention.
Those cops know who you are, she said. They look at you to see how to act.
She stood steady, shrugged her shoulders, opened her palms. There it was true. Crawford performed a measurement on his cold scales.
Duly noted, Starling. I'll get on with the bug.
Yes, sir. She watched him walk away. A middle-aged man, laden with cases and rumpled from flying, his cuffs muddy from the riverbank, going home to what he did at home. She would have killed for him then. That was one of Crawford's great talents. Chapter 14. The Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History had been closed for hours, but Crawford had called ahead, and a guard waited to let Clarice Starling in the Constitution Avenue entrance. The lights were dimmed in the closed museum, and the air was still. Only the colossal figure of a South Seas chieftain facing the entrance stood tall enough for the weak ceiling light to shine on his face. Starling's guide was a big black man in the neat turnout of the Smithsonian guards. She thought he resembled the chieftain as he raised his face to the elevator lights. There was a moment's relief in her idle fancy, like rubbing a cramp. The second level above the great stuffed elephant, a vast floor closed to the public, is shared by the departments of anthropology and entomology. The anthropologists call it the fourth floor. The entomologists contend it is the third. A few scientists from agriculture say they have proof that it is the sixth. Each faction has a case in the old building with its additions and subdivisions. Starling followed the guard into a dim maze of corridors walled high with wooden cases of anthropological specimens. Only the small labels revealed their contents.
"Thousands of people in these boxes," the guard said. 40,000 specimens.
He found office numbers with his flashlight and trailed the light over the labels as they went along. Dyak baby carriers and ceremonial skulls gave way to aphids, and they left man for the older and more orderly world of insects. Now the corridor was walled with big metal boxes painted pale green.
30 million insects. And the spiders on top of that. Don't lump the spiders in with the insects, the guard advised. Spider people jump all over you about that.
There, the office that's lit. Don't try to come out by yourself. If they don't say they'll bring you down, call me at this extension. It's the guard office. I'll come get you. He gave her a card and left her. She was in the heart of entomology, on a rotunda gallery high above the great stuffed elephant. There was the office with the lights on, and the